Welcome back from your last break of the evening. Let me begin by making an announcement that I intend to go on the videotape. That's why I'm doing it now. Relating to the reading of that little book called The Art of Biblical History, those of you who are actually investigating the syllabus in advance of the Faithful Hours when things come due, realize that next week we will be discussing that particular book, and there is a test planned to cover the material of that book, you know, the big things, not all the details. What I think I will do is give you a take-home test on that book that you will get received next week. That means that we will have discussed the book at least in part, if not in whole, before you take the test. And so that is not by any means to encourage you to think, well, I'll just listen to the discussion and I won't read the book. Okay, so do read the book. But let me alert you in advance, again, if you haven't started reading it, that it is a book that is maybe a little different from the normal coffee table book or, the easy reading kind of book that you might prefer. It is a little more monographic, or what you would call a monograph. It is a bit of a stretch if you haven't read anything in the field of historiography to feel comfortable with it. I realize that. I apologize for that. I still hope that you will benefit from wading through it. Don't get bogged down too much in details. Try to get the big picture. And in the interest of helping you do that, let me just rehearse one more time, very briefly, what the big questions are. Okay? I think I may have mentioned at the beginning of this course how the outline of that book came to me. Now, this is not the big questions on the test. This is the big questions in the chapters. Just to give you a very, very brief orientation as you get into it, or if you're lost somewhere in the middle of it, this may help you a little bit. In chapter 1, the question is the Bible a history book? Is it a history textbook? How are we to regard it? In other words, when we pick up the Bible, what kind of literature are we reading? Now, most scholars, liberal, conservative, of all stripes, will say, no, the Bible's not a history book per se. And I think they're right. It is far more than that. It's also not a theology book, not a philosophy book, not a book of linguistics, not a book of economics, not a book of all these different things. But it is of interest in many of those areas, and it does have a very, very definite historical interest. So we answer the question negatively. No, it's not a history book. It's really a library of different literary genre, different literary forms. You've got poetry, you've got prose, you've got wisdom writings, you've got gospels, you have epistles and such. So the Bible is a library of texts, which if you wanted to describe very generally, you would have to describe as, well, it's religious literature. And if you're a believer, you'd say it's God's Word. That's the simple way of going at it. Well, that first chapter deals with the nature of the genre of the Bible. What is it we have when we look at the Bible? A library of works. What brings them all together? How are we to regard them? And that kind of question. So the first question is the Bible a history book? The second question that is addressed in chapter 2 is, what is history anyway? What is history anyway? Is history a simple video recording of just what happened? Or is history something more creative, more compressed, more selective, more perspectival than that? You see why it's hard to read my book? Okay, that's the second question, and it's addressed in chapter 2. The third question is, well, is the historicity of the Bible even important? Is it important that the things that are recounted in the Bible as having happened, is it important that they happened? Couldn't we simply learn from the stories? Do the stories have to be true stories, that is, historical stories? So that question is addressed in chapter 3, and I'll let you guess my conclusion. Better read the conclusion. In chapter 4, the question is, why do scholars disagree? You know, if historicity is or isn't important, I'll let you guess which I think it is. Why do scholars disagree about the historical import and the historical accuracy of the Bible? And there I kind of do a sweeping look at different perspectives that are brought to bear by different students of the Bible, different approaches that they bring, and the way in which the methods they employ are a reflection of the models of reality that form their background beliefs. It's really a look at the way in which the worldview which we embrace influences the way we look at things and the way we approach the Bible. And you'll be introduced to traditional historical criticism, sociological approaches to the Bible, new archaeological approaches, literary approaches, even terms like deconstruction and that. So it's kind of a sweeping survey of scholarship, and that's another reason that it's a kind of a scary chapter. But those who are willing to read through it, even if you haven't heard of these terms before, I do try to explain them as best I can in going through. So again, don't get bogged down and frustrated by the details. Try to get the big point and keep moving. Don't expect necessarily that if you haven't read in this area at all to understand everything first time around. I keep apologizing for the nature of the book. Those who have read in the area like it, or at least many of them do. Then the final chapter is, well, actually it's not the final chapter, it's the fifth chapter is how then, you know, with all this background and all these issues that we have discussed, how then do we go about reading the Bible, asking the question, what are its historical claims? When I read an account in the Bible, how do I know if it's historical or not? When I read about the axe head that the prophet and kings caused to float to the surface, is that, you know, just a fabulous tale, or am I to envisage an axe head actually floating to the surface of the water? And what would help me to decide that question? Is this prophetic legend, or is this prophetic historiography? What is it? And so that chapter 5 is where I really try to hammer out a method and approach that will help us find answers to those questions. It doesn't mean that we can find answers to absolutely every question and be absolutely certain at every turn as to whether we're to take something as absolutely historical or not. Okay? But it does provide a general framework and a general approach. And then the sixth chapter will seem very familiar to you because it's an extended example applying that reading strategy from chapter 5 to the Saul material, which we have talked about at length in this class. So chapter 6 should be nice review to you. But I do encourage you to read it in particular because there's some nice charts in there that chart out the structure of arguments, and you can kind of see it visually how you go through. It is, however, a deceptively long book for being so small. The publisher did that by intent, narrowed the margins, used small type. So be prepared for 60,000 words. And get out your Evelyn Woods manual and get to work if you haven't already. Try to read it by next week. You will have, however, a bit longer before you have to take the take-home and bring it back to me, because the take-home will be due the week after next. Okay, you'll get it next week, and the week after next you'll need to give it back. We will reserve questions on that until next week, unless there's something housekeeping we have to do. Okay, now we have 15 minutes to handle the rest of 2 Samuel. Now, we can let a little of it spill over. Let me do this very quickly. We were in 2 Samuel 6. We're talking about David's reign blessed by God. Sometimes people call this David under the blessing, as contrasted with 2 Samuel 11 and following, David under the curse. I used to use that as a title, and it really bothered a student, so I backed away from that, because David is not really under the curse. That sounds a little strong. It's really David's sin and its consequences that we discover as we move on into chapter 11 and following. Let me just very quickly hammer or run through what happens up to chapter 10, to and including chapter 10. Chapter 6, the Ark of the Covenant is brought to Israel. Chapter 7, we reach what has often been described as the theological summit of the Old Testament. The theological summit of the Old Testament, and that is the Davidic promise, or the dynastic promise, given by God through Nathan to David. Remember, David wanted to build a temple, a house for the Lord, and Nathan thought, hey, that sounds like a good idea, go ahead. God soon reversed that and said, Nathan, wait a minute, no, you didn't ask me. That's not the plan. David is not to do it. His son will do it. And so the Lord then graciously, through Nathan, says, David, you're not to build me a house, but I will build you an eternal house. You're not going to build me a temple, but I will give you an eternal a dynasty that will go on forever. And David is, of course, astonished by this promise. He says, to what other human being have you ever spoken thusly? This is astonishing. In this theological summit of the Old Testament, we have gathered up and focused on David the promise to the patriarchs. There are references there that I'll not take time to point out. But if you read back through it, you'll see, oh, that reminds us of a promise that was made to Abraham. And now it's being focused in on David. And then from that focus, it then presses forward and becomes a messianic hope, a hope for the future when God will bring the Messiah with a capital M, who would be the greater son of David, Christ himself. So this becomes the seedbed, as it were, for the messianic consciousness that then begins to develop and grow in the Old Testament. So a very important chapter. I don't need to take time to discuss it at length, because we're going to use this chapter later in this course as we compare Samuel and Chronicles, and see something about the nature and the flexibility of biblical historiography. So we'll come back to this chapter at that point. Chapter 8, we read of David's victories. We have a summary of his victories. It resembles in many respects the summary of Saul's victories and Saul's reign back in 1 Samuel chapter 14, beginning, I think, in verse 47, but with one very significant difference. David and Saul fought many of the same enemies. Both of them won many victories. But in the summary of David's reign, and not in the summary of Saul's reign, we read, the Lord gave David victory wherever he went. Verse 6, verse 14, the Lord gave David victory wherever he went. An expression of the Lord's continual presence with David, something we never hear of Saul, but we hear repeatedly in the life of David. The Lord gave David victory. The Lord was with David. In chapter 9, we have the story of Mephibosheth, the surviving son, the crippled son of Jonathan, to whom David shows kindness because of his covenant with Jonathan, seeking to fulfill what he can to his departed friend Jonathan, and he brings Mephibosheth into his household. Now, again, the cynical readers say, aha, he wanted to keep the competition under his immediate oversight. Well, you know, David's a sinful individual. Maybe he did have that as an ulterior motive, but that is certainly not what the text says. It says that David wanted to show kindness to Jonathan, and he sought out a surviving son of Jonathan in order to do that, and it happened to be Mephibosheth. Chapter 10 then recounts David's last major campaign against foreign powers. He sort of secures the boundaries. He is set. He is successful. And then we come to chapter 11. And then we come to that other outline that you should have before you that is entitled David's Sin and Its Consequences. We move from David under the blessing to, if you will, David under the curse. Perhaps better, David's sin and its consequences. And let's just see what we can accomplish in the few minutes remaining, looking at this section, not the brightest period in David's life, but it begins in chapter 11, in verse 1, in the spring, at the time when kings go off to war, David sent Joab out with the king's men and the whole Israelite army. Now, that's the kind of catchphrase that has been used in many, many sermons. In the spring, when kings go off to war, David sent Joab. And I think those sermons are on target. I think that's what the text is trying to say. David was king. It was spring. He should have been off to war, but he sent Joab. David was beginning to get a bit too comfortable. And as if this is not clear enough, we go on to read that in verse 2, one evening, David got up from his bed and walked around on the roof of the palace. One evening, he got up from his bed. He apparently was becoming a couch potato, I suppose. He was beginning to simply lie around, it seems. When kings were off at war, David was getting too comfortable. And I would entitle this chapter, The High Cost of Getting Comfortable. Or perhaps, The Hazards of Success, Part 2. Remember, I had one earlier section entitled The Hazards of Success. This might be The Hazards of Success, Part 2. But better, I think, The High Cost of Getting Comfortable. Notice in these first two verses that I've just read that you have, that narrative characteristic of showing rather than telling. David is not explicitly condemned, but we are shown that he's getting comfortable, maybe getting a little lazy, getting a little casual. He's not on his guard. He's not really where he should be. And so he walks into temptation. He's on top of the roof of the palace, and from the roof he saw a woman bathing, and the woman was very beautiful. And you know the story of his sin with Bathsheba. Bathsheba appears more or less as not a fully developed character in this. We don't know really what her response was, what her actions were. We can only assume that she would have protested being taken by the king here. We're simply not told. All the focus is on David's actions. He saw what he wanted. He took it. He was king. Who can stop him? Now, in chapter 12, however, it becomes apparent that despite his best efforts, David is not to get away with things. Nathan comes to David and he tells him a story. And one thing you'll find that I stress in the book you'll be reading this week, if you haven't already started, is the importance of recognizing the genre, the literary type of a story you read, or perhaps of a story you are told. And David made a genre mistake here. He didn't really recognize the form of the story that Nathan was telling him, because he assumed that the story of the rich man who had so many sheep and the poor man who had but the one little lamb, and when the rich man had a guest come to town, the rich man took the little lamb that belonged to the poor man and had it prepared and fed his guest with the one little lamb of the poor man. David understood this to be a judicial case desiring judgment, and he rendered judgment. The man who did that shall surely die. But it was a genre mistake, because it wasn't a judicial case, it was a parable. And having pronounced judgment, then Nathan said, "You're the man. Don't you get it? Don't you see? This was a parable. You are guilty." Here we notice a striking difference between David and Saul. Remember, Saul, when caught red-handed, had a number of excuses at his disposal. He played them to the hilt in chapter 15 of 1 Samuel. And only when there was nothing more that he could possibly say did he confess and admit, "Okay, I've sinned, but honor me before the elders and before my people, and I'll bow before the Lord your God." Well, in this instance, David, when he is finally uncovered, now he had attempted a cover-up. You know that. He had attempted to convince Uriah to go home, to come back from battle, and tried to convince him to go and be with his wife and refresh himself and such. And Uriah said, "No, that would be wrong for me to do while the army of Israel is in the field, for me to go home." Ooh, that must have pricked a little bit David's conscience. And it's a very interesting little drama that you have going on between David and Uriah in chapter 11, because the question is, who knows what? And who thinks the other one knows what? And back and forth. And you really don't know who knows what. You know that David knows everything, except David doesn't know what Uriah may know or may not know. Were all of Uriah's comments purely innocent or not? It's a very interesting thing to try to explore. And I think it's one of those gaps that a narrative sometimes opens up that it doesn't really intend for us ever to close. The whole affair remains mysterious. We never really know how much Uriah may have learned, may have guessed. But at any rate, he resists David's attempt to make him help with the cover-up. And so David is eventually caught. But he's caught not by the circumstances, but by the prophet of God, as he comes and says, "You are the man." When he does so, David responds by saying in verse 13, "I have sinned against the Lord." Period. He doesn't say, so then return with me and honor me before the elders of my people or anything else. David comes clean and says, it had to be uncovered. He was a sinful man, but he said, I have sinned against the Lord. And Nathan replies, the Lord has taken away your sin. You're not going to die. But because by doing this you have made the enemies of the Lord show utter contempt, the son born to you will die. We should never think that because we are under grace and not under law, that sin has absolutely no consequences. All you have to do is sin for a day and you will discover that sin does have consequences. The point is, we don't find our way to God by behaving and ceasing to sin. We are God's by virtue of His coming to us in grace and adopting us as His children. That's the point of grace that we like to stress. But do not be deceived into thinking that because we are under grace, our behavior makes absolutely no difference in what we experience in this life. Our sin does have consequences. David's sin had grave consequences that not only involved the death of this young child who was conceived in an adulterous relationship, but also continuing consequences in the life of David and his children. Immediately following chapter 12, we come to one of those chapters which is not really children's bedside reading. You know, we all think that we should read the Bible to our children. Well, yeah, but remember, this is a book for adults. I mean, it's for children. The gospel is for children. Parts of it are for children, but not every part, I don't think, should be read to a child, at least not without some masking of the details or something. I don't know quite how you would read this particular chapter of the rape of Tamar by her half-brother Amnon. You know the story. You're not children. You have read it. You've been required to. But interesting to me, in the aftermath of what David has done and the fact that he has been forgiven, interesting to me is the way in which David responds when he hears what Amnon has done. It says in chapter 13, verse 21, when King David heard all this, he was furious and apparently nothing. Why? Because, the communists, because he was guilty too. Yes, indeed he was. He had committed murder. He had committed adultery. He had taken another man's wife. Those are every bit the equal to what Amnon has done here. Was this therefore the right thing for David to do? I see a few heads shaking no, a few others just nodding off no. Why not? Why was this, if this was not the right thing for David to do, how would we explain it? Why was this not right? What's the simple saying that we sometimes use? Yeah, I hear several sayings. The one I was thinking of is, two wrongs don't make a right. Now, that may seem highly simplistic in dealing with this kind of complex moral, ethical issue and situation, but I think that's true. If we operate out of a sense of weakness and guilt in dealing with our children, where will that get us? I mean, what sin, what disobedience could our children possibly do that we're not guilty of? I mean, probably they're not going to better us in their sin. They're never going to go beyond us where we can occupy the moral high ground and say, well, I would never have done that, and you shouldn't either. They're probably going to do the same things we have done. But that does not mean that we should then be overly permissive and not take responsibility as parents and not recognize that it is our responsibility as those in authority over them to bring discipline into their lives, to train them, just as God brings discipline into our lives. And there's nothing hypocritical in that. What would be hypocritical is if we have extricated ourselves from under the Lord's discipline, and if we are living for ourselves, and if we're living, going our own way and just saying, forget it, God, I don't care what you say, I'm not going to obey you, you're not my father. If we're living that way, then it is hypocritical. But if we recognize in the depth of our sin that God is disciplining us, and it's right that He do so, and we're submissive to that, then we shouldn't be crippled by the guilt of our past, and thus disabled in dealing rightly with our children. David was furious, and he did nothing. Now, this will begin a chain of events that will continue not now, but next week. And it begins with Absalom, who was Tamar's full brother. And we'll see how that works itself out next week. We will also be discussing the art of biblical history next week, so I won't take inordinate amounts of time on this. So we will stop there for this evening.